Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Adolfo Ramirez Zamora, an Associate Professor and Program Director and Chief of the Division of Movement Disorders at the University of Florida. He detailed the current state of care for patients who have advanced Parkinson's disease, as well as a little bit of information on the ongoing clinical development of therapies for this condition, what challenges are still lingering around in the clinic, and where the field is headed in the future. Let's dive in.
Associate Professor in the Department of Neurology at the University of Florida at the Normal Fixell Neurological Institute and the Chief of the Movement Disorder Division here, and I also coordinate most of our clinical research here at the University of Florida. So I've been practicing in the field of movement disorders for over a decade, and my interest, I have a wide interest in management of all movement disorders, but I also dedicate some of my practice to the use of advanced therapies for Parkinson's disease, deep brain stimulation, and botulinum toxin injections. I think that there has been significant advancements in the management of the motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease. So we used to refer to these patients as advanced patients when they entered the state of the disease where motor fluctuations, dyskinesia, wearing off, and some of these unpredictable responses to the medication became more prominent. But those fluctuations, those changes do not necessarily correlate with changes in quality of life. And some of the non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's are incredibly disruptive of daily activities. And when we start, people have tried in different ways to define advanced Parkinson's disease, and it seems like it makes sense to define it on the basis of motor symptoms, on the basis of disease longevity and progression, and maybe on non-motor symptoms as well. It's very clear for us in the field that patients that have advanced Parkinson's from a progression of the disease perspective, where they enter the phase where dopamine medications are not as effective, and there's a big need of treatments for that group of patients. That stage of the disease is commonly characterized by problems with memory and concentration, balance problems, anxiety and depression, and lack of motivation. And those features don't respond very well to levodopa or dopaminergic medications at that point. And we need better therapies for that. When it comes down to the advanced patients that are advanced in the area of motor fluctuations, we have seen so many advances and improvements in that area. We have seen the recent approval of extended release levodopa 5-6 years ago. There's a few add-on medications. There's a lot of research investigating new mechanisms to enhance the effectiveness of levodopa. And new therapies are becoming available, including not only DBS and the improvement in DBS technologies, but also infusions of levodopa through the medical port into the small intestines like Duopa, and then subcutaneous therapies. There's actually new medications that are helpful for acute worsening of Parkinsonism, so rescue medications as well. So that seems to be an area that has seen a lot of growth and a lot of opportunity as well. They're not perfect. Even with some of these advanced therapies, patients still have motor fluctuations. They don't resolve these problems, but they are significantly better and compared to medical management in general. And we also need some better treatment for some of these non-motor features of the disease, particularly when they're the leading source of disability or really prominent.
It's interesting that you mentioned, because that does seem to be, you know, that when people, and I imagine too, just sort of the lay population, when they think of Parkinson's disease, those motor fluctuations are sort of the motor symptoms are kind of the first thing that come to mind. And, you know, there's a lot of conversations I'm sure you've heard from just colleagues and being, you know, in the neuro space that, you know, with MS, there's a lot of conversations about the invisible symptoms of the disease, the things that, you know, don't have the physical, you can see it in. And I wondered, do you think that it sounds like that's kind of a major area of need in Parkinson? I mean, I know there's some stuff going on to kind of address the cognitive issues, but do you find that, you know, fatigue and just sort of other related to things like cognitive challenges, do you find that a lot of patients are experiencing challenges like that? And is there enough focus on those sort of patient reported outcomes, the things that the patients find to be most beneficial in terms of the types of treatments that are being researched and developed right now?
Right. No, that's a really good point. I think that we're just starting to recognize some of this compared to other fields. And there's a huge need to really evolve this area and better understand how to treat these patients better, how to assess the effectiveness of medications better, look at other therapies as well, because these are very common and very bothersome, troublesome symptoms for patients. And it's interesting because we neglected some of these symptoms for the longest time. If you go back 10 years or 15 years ago and you look at Parkinson's chapters in the textbooks of neurology, there was maybe one paragraph about cognitive impairment, and there were a few paragraphs about maybe some mood disorders. There was nothing about fatigue. There was nothing about sleep. There was absolutely nothing about pain. And those are really, really impactful symptoms in our patients that can actually, in a significant number of them, they drive the disability on these patients. And we don't have as many trials looking at them, and we're just starting to better understand some of the symptoms. And I think that in the past decade or the past 5 years, the field has really shifted into paying attention to some of these motor features and developing new scales. For example, we have seen incredible growth in the number of scales that are specific for Parkinson's when it comes to pain, anxiety, apathy, and so on, because we keep learning about some of these symptoms that are quite important, and some of them even precede the onset of Parkinson's. At our institution, for example, we recently launched a new initiative where we're having a dedicated multidisciplinary clinic that is composed by a neurologist, a GI doctor, a speech therapist, and a dietitian, because of the powerful effects of Parkinson's on the gastrointestinal tract. So just thinking about the GI symptoms, the entire gastrointestinal tract is affected in Parkinson's. And we think about it, maybe constipation is a common symptom, but there are so many things, so many symptoms that we need to untangle. And I think that we're going to see more and more of these type of collaborations.
Yeah, the multidisciplinary care is interesting, because that's another one that just sort of seems, you know, across these sort of complex diseases, because it does seem like the more we find out about a lot of them, the more we realize that, you know, the effects of the disease sort of span outside of just what they do to, you know, the brain or the central nervous system or you know, motor ability and things like that. You know, you mentioned obviously that the research has kind of shifted a little bit in recent years, and I'm curious for you what you would label as kind of the biggest, whether it's one thing that sticks out particularly or maybe a handful of sort of successes or trends in the right direction, so to say, in terms of things that impact the daily clinical care of patients. Has there been anything in the past few years that's kind of stuck out to you as like, you know, I have noticed right away the impact that this has had on the field, whether, like I said, it's the care of the individual patient or just sort of what you're seeing the field, you know, react to?
Right. I think I cannot really think of a change that was so impactful that really shifted the way that we treat patients per se. I think that there have been a bunch of smaller victories when it comes down to better understanding and treating the disease. We haven't had a lot of home runs when it comes down to some of these symptoms. I think that we're still struggling trying to figure out ways to slow down or delay progression of the disease. And that's the biggest clinical need that we have right now. How can we, even if it's not a cure, how can we delay the progression of the disease? And we, I think that the field is shifting in trying to better understand the mechanisms behind the symptoms of Parkinson's. Parkinson's disease is not a single disease. Is in a sense is a phenotype, is a syndrome, is a manifestation of brain changes and pathology that may be very different among individuals. So there's a lot of interest in collecting biological samples that can give us a more biological signature to each patient. So they may look very different, or they may look the same in the outside, but they could have a homogeneous mechanism and biology that is driving the disease. So we may have a better chance to target a specific targeted therapies for that mechanism, so we can slow down the disease progression. There is, as I said before, there has been so many advancement in therapies to manage non-motor motor symptoms, but in the non-motor symptom area and disease progression, I think that there is still room for improvements. Maybe some singles, maybe a double here and there, but no home runs yet.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you gotta play baseball like that, right?
We're gonna take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Ramirez Zamora to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology since the last time we saw you. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. The FDA has elected to approve JZP-258, otherwise known as Xywav, for the treatment of idiopathic hypersomnia, making it the first treatment approved for this indication. The combination agent of calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium oxybates will be available to patients in the fourth quarter of this year following a REMS implementation. The sNDA for the drug was supported by data from a double-blind, multicenter, randomized phase 3 trial featuring patients who had EDS associated with idiopathic hypersomnia, and all of those treated with the agent experienced clinically meaningful improvements in Epworth Sleepiness Scale scores. Also in sleep disorder news, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, or AASM, has published a new guideline for the treatment of central disorders of hypersomnolence, the first update since 2007 for these disorders. The guideline provides a total of 20 recommendations for the use of medications for adults, including solriamfetol and pitolisant. Two additional recommendations are specific to pediatric patients with narcolepsy, suggesting the conditional use of modafinil or sodium oxybate, which was approved by the FDA in 2018 for use in children ages 7 years and older. Alexion Pharmaceuticals has announced that it is discontinuing its Phase 3 Champion ALS trial of ravulizumab, marketed as Ultoramus, in ALS. The decision was reached based on a recommendation from the Independent Data Monitoring Committee's pre-specified interim analysis, which suggested that the trial be discontinued due to a lack of efficacy. Those enrolled in the study will discontinue treatment with ravulizumab and complete their necessary follow-up visits, with the remaining data planned to be used to inform ongoing research. Otherwise, no new safety data were collected, with the overall safety profile maintaining consistency to prior study of the long-acting C5 complement inhibitor. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Ramirez Zamora.
I'm curious, you know, I know you mentioned that it's a syndrome, and I've heard that a couple times in the last few years. And I wonder, do you think that Parkinson's, and it might be because our understanding of the disease just, you know, I mean, we just aren't fully there yet, but do you think that there will reach a point where it's almost not necessarily renamed, but reclassified to an extent because of kind of all the things that are going on with these patients and the uniqueness of each patient when it comes down to the actual clinical care that needs to be provided to them?
I really hope so. And I think that we will. It may take some time because I think that two things need to happen first. We need to develop a good, reliable biomarker so we can monitor disease progression using a marker that is not, that doesn't rely on clinical examinations, and we're limited in that regard. But once we develop that, I think that we're going to continue to expand our understanding of the genetics of the disease, understanding the specific inflammatory changes, maybe changes in gut microbiome, and even physiology. So I think eventually at some point, grabbing from all these different areas, we're going to start putting last name to Parkinson's. So we're going to say you have Parkinson's disease due to this, this, and that with very specific signatures. I think we'll see at some point we'll be able to classify and segregate patients based on their biology. It may not be immediate, but I really hope so. And I think that it's exciting times, and I think it's doable.
Absolutely. And then speaking to that, is there anything, you know, within the research, whether it's looking into sort of the underlying pathologies of the disease or just the clinical development that's going on or searching for a biomarker, is there anything that you've sort of kept your eye on across those sort of areas of research and development or that you're, you know, kind of looking forward to finding out more about as the work kind of continues?
Yeah, no, I can comment. I can say a few things. I think that when it comes down to obtaining a biomarker, there's a lot of really interesting candidates. People are looking at serum proteins, like looking at the different ratios or the amounts of the specific proteins that may help us to follow up disease progression or monitor disease progression going forward. And I think that that's a very exciting field as we continue to develop better techniques to look for these proteins. I think that it would be very practical. There are some people looking at eye images, looking at the retina, for example, as a really like a window to the brain. It's commonly used in other neurological problems, and different groups are trying to validate ways to look at disease progression by looking at changes in the eye. And I think that imaging is going to be really helpful. So far, to this day, there are a couple of different groups that have develop new techniques that appear to be quite helpful to separate among different disease states and also monitor progression. So I think that's really exciting. Once we have imaging that may not be affected by medications and maybe not affected by clinical features or fluctuations, that will really open the door for something new. The idea of Parkinson being caused by changes in different areas of the body, starting in the gut, and the interaction between the gastrointestinal tract and inflammation, and the relationship of those changes with certain types of genetic predispositions or genetic subtypes of PD. I think that's really intriguing. I think it's taking a lot of momentum trying to really untangle how neuroinflammation leads the progression of the disease and what's causing it. Is this something that it's secondary to a certain event? Is this related to changes in other systems in the body, or is a response to those changes? It's quite interesting because the interplay between the environment, we have known for a long time that there's some patients with Parkinson's that have a higher risk of developing Parkinson's, but even if you have a brother that has the same genetic risk, the brother may not get Parkinson's. There's all these environmental factors that play a role. So I think that we're now starting to look at the interplay between genes and some of these metabolic or inflammatory markers. How do they interact? What happens that kickstarts the process of neurodegeneration? That's really, really exciting fields and exciting areas of development to better understand the disease. And I think that also the development of new therapies is still quite exciting at this time. We're really looking in a long time. We have been doing clinical trials for a long time, but kind of like looking at the same mechanisms related to dopamine. And right now we're seeing newer and newer mechanisms of action that may open the door to new treatments that have different side effect profiles that may be complementary to some of the things that we already have in clinics. So these new areas of new mechanisms of approaching the disease are also quite exciting.
Absolutely. And the last thing I want to ask you, and thank you very much for your time. You've been very generous. I you know, a lot of it sounds like obviously trying to sort of identify the disease earlier is always important. And that seems to be a theme kind of across the stretch of neurology and a number of the diseases that we're talking to people about. And I'm curious for you, do you think that whether it's awareness efforts or education efforts or just, you know, making sure that because these are, again, patients that are going to require multidisciplinary care. And a lot of times we talk about this, how the sort of the buck starts in like primary care. Do you think that the identification process of these patients, sort of figuring out who's at risk or who might be at risk and who's starting to develop these signs and symptoms or have onset of symptoms, do you think that that's in a good place for now, or that there's anywhere particularly that you think kind of needs improvement?
Well, that's a really great question. I think that there's a lot we need to improve that area quite a bit. I think that there's a lot of misconceptions out there, and it's hard to get care by the neurologists, especially movement disorder neurologists, because there's just not enough of them, and everyone is busy, and a lot of these patients are seen by primary care doctors or other neurologists, and there is, I think that a tendency to say, well, you know, you have Parkinson's, or you have a tremor, let's just take levodopa and we'll see you back in 6 months, and take it when you need it. You listen to your body and adjust it. And there's a lot of that. And I think that now the understanding the need for a multidisciplinary approach with very early intervention when it comes down to rehabilitation strategies and potential participation in some of these studies is really important for patients to be empowered to fight the disease, but also to advance the field. And I think there are many reasons, practical reasons, that makes it really hard. The access to care, obviously, is a challenge. Education from patients and families is also, there's a need for that. Not uncommonly, you know, you walk around and then say, well, yeah, grandpa shakes, and that's what happens when you get older, and you know, it's just part of life. But there may be things that we could do in clinic to try to help some of these patients, and the same goes with finding the right diagnosis. There's a lot of overlap among some of these conditions, and sometimes that becomes quite challenging, and not having quick access to some of these providers makes it even harder. So I think that there are many layers at multiple levels that could potentially improve access and identification of some of these patients. Going back to your point, I think that eventually we want to be successful in slowing down disease progression. We may want to intervene as early as possible. And at this time and age, you could potentially identify patients even before they have the classic symptoms of Parkinson's, what we refer to as prodromal PV, and that's a completely different effort, trying to identify people that may have dopamine deficiencies before they have symptoms of Parkinson's, but they have that deficiency with other symptoms like acting out their dreams or constipation, or they lose their sense of smell. There's a lot of challenges to what do we call these patients? How do we engage them in research? And we don't have anything that is going to slow down disease progression. Does it matter if we bring them into the clinic? What are we going to do for them? So it's at some point we need to start somewhere, and we need to develop a plan that is strategic, that makes sense, that involves patients so they can provide feedback, and then continue to study, and hopefully in the near future be able to have one of those agents that is going to slow down the disease.
Listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.